On the telephone from Wellington, I have Jan Wright. She's the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment. And so I say kia ora and welcome to the show, Jan.
Thank you, Tim.
Jan, what is your role as the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment?
It takes a bit of explaining, Tim, but I'll do my best to try and keep it simple. The first thing is that word Parliament, Parliamentary Commissioner. And although I am, if you like, a public servant, I'm not a servant of government, I'm a servant of Parliament as a whole. And that is the special thing about the role, makes me independent. So I can say things freely. The Auditor General and the Ombudsman are in a similar position. They're also parliamentary officers. So that's the first thing. And the role was created in 23 years ago in the Environment Act, 1986. And that piece of law created the Ministry for the Environment and the Parliamentary Commissioner. So the office has been going for that long, and I'm the third commissioner. The first one was Helen Hughes, and in her day it was very much an ombudsman type role where people made complaints to her because there weren't other mechanisms around for making complaints to, not as many agencies managing the environment. And also it was the birth of environmental impact assessments. So the office did a lot of those. Morgan Williams was the second one, or Helen, I should say, did 2 5-year terms, and Morgan also. And Morgan, as many of your listeners will know, was very strong on the public education side of things and sustainability, made sustainability well understood through the country, and was particularly well known for a major report on the intensification of agriculture called Growing for Good, which some of your listeners may have heard. So I think there's a bit of a different flavour that comes with each commissioner. And my flavour is an emphasis on working with Parliament and trying to really get there and be influential with the MPs. And also because I do have a lot of training in economics, which seems far from environment, but I use economics to make environmental points, if you like. So that's a bit of a beginning, Tim.
Well, that's fantastic that you are involved with economics, because the perception is with the governments of the world today is that economics is the only thing that's going to keep everything alive. But, of course, as you know, we derive everything from the planet. The whole environment actually gives us all the goods and services that we require. So could you explain maybe just a little bit of how you interface with the government? Is it Treasury or Minister of Finance?
No, it's Parliament itself, and so in several ways, really. One of them is through giving advice to select committees, so they may be considering a bill which is on its way to become law. The way this works is that you have these readings in the House and Parliament, and you have a first reading, a second reading, and a third reading. And during that procedure, the bill is referred to a select committee who will consider it and make changes in it. And it's a refinement, if you like, to the legislation. And it's a very, it really is the real work of Parliament, actually. And so at the moment in Parliament, we have a committee which is reviewing the Emissions Trading Scheme, which is the act that was introduced by the last government towards the end of last year, which was putting a price on carbon dioxide as a way of helping mitigate climate change. And the new government is planning to make some amendments to that act. And so we are involved there as advisors on that. And it's enormously complex, and it does involve a lot of economics, of course. So that's an example. Another one was the waste minimisation bill, and so on. That's one way, a major way of interacting with Parliament. Another way is when investigations and reports are complete, we can offer briefings on those to groups of MPs. Select committees might ask to come along and present to them. I was asked by the Primary Production Committee, which deals with agriculture and fishing and so on, to come and talk to them about water a while ago, so I went along. And so there is a kind of educating of MPs that goes on as well. So it's very much, we don't report to Treasury or indeed to any minister, and the reporting line is actually to the Speaker of the House, and he's the conduit through to Parliament.
Is there urgency in the way you express the need for us to embrace more environmental awareness, or do you have to have it sort of quietly reasoned out, and essentially the government at present is perceived to be as sort of pro-business, so therefore if business is imperative, then the environment takes the back seat. You can tell this by how the Green Party has steadfastly refused to want to associate with the National Party, and it may not have been a good decision, but when you have a political party of national in power at the moment, do they see the urgency possibly that you may see it?
Tim, I can't comment on any particular political party because the nature of the job is that I have to be completely non-political. And if I looked as if I was being party political in any sense, then the independence would go. You know, I would be seen as not independent and not listened to. So I do have to be keeping a watch on that independence, and the perception of that independence is enormously important. But your question is actually a good one in terms of where you started off with urgency about what I say to Parliament. And this is hard. We have a mission within the office, and the mission is to maintain or improve the quality of the environment by providing robust, independent advice that influences decisions, right? So by robust, we really mean well-reasoned, so that you make it very clear what the source of that advice is. And, of course, the independence gives it some power. So you can say things that will be unpopular. There might be something that's unpopular with all political parties. But if you want to influence decisions, it really is take quite a bit of thinking of how you can do that. And you can say things that are very distant from where parliamentary heads might be at the moment, and in which case they probably are going to say, well, we know we're near that, that's so far out of our comfort zone, there's no way we can go there, we wouldn't get political support, very interesting, but, you know. Or what we can do is to try and say, well, here's a recommendation, because this advice comes in the form of recommendations, here's a recommendation that I'm making, and really phrasing those and crafting them so that it would be feasible, in fact, for the minister or whoever the recommendation is to actually take that advice and do it. And so, in that sense, if you're going to be effective, you have to be somewhat incremental. Sometimes, of course, it's going to be important to put a stake in the ground and say, this is it. But other times, it's a matter of trying to lead in a certain direction.
Yes.
Does that make sense to you?
It does. I understand very well. So how do you decide what to do?
How do I decide what to do? Well, it is a difficult job. There's an infinite number of worthwhile things to do. There are 7 functions sitting in the Act about controlling what I do. And what we do is to aim to make a difference. And the value of that is based on the independence. So we wouldn't do, for example, we need a series of filters here, we wouldn't do, for example, something that a government agency should be doing, because that's their job. We might say they should do that, they should be doing this, and they're not, but we wouldn't do it. The timeliness is very important. So with the select committee work, for example, if you're not ready and able to engage in that process, you're going to miss the boat. So there has to be quite a lot of flexibility around this, because a lot of it can be reactive. This is the time to say a certain thing because the bill is before a select committee, or maybe because the subject is high in the public consciousness, this is the time to actually get some traction. So that's part of it. And then I do also think about the importance of the issue, and things to me are really important if the environmental damage is accelerating in some sense, if it's irreversible, for example. Those things alarm me.
Yes.
So cannot emphasize enough that every week people tell me what I should be doing, because there's no end of things to do. And really it's also, of course, looking at the capability within the office and the kinds of expertise we have and the kinds of knowledge we have, so that we can say something that is well-grounded. Because if we rush in and give advice that is not soundly reasoned or based on, you know, some good evidence, then the credibility can be gone in a flash. And of course, when you say things independently, they are going to be unpopular with some people, and so again, it's that matter of credibility. It makes it even more important that it's high quality, robust.
Could you give the listeners an example of some of these issues that you do investigate?
Sure. Well, there's one that came out last year, which Morgan Williams had begun, and that actually was triggered by complaints to the office from residents at Mapua near Nelson to do with the clean-up of a contaminated site there. And so that project took quite some finishing, and that report is on our website for any of your readers who are, sorry, listeners, I should say, who are interested in reading it.
And that website is www.pce.government.gov.nz.
And we found some significant problems there, and we're being cross-examined in a select committee about that. So that was to do with possible release of dioxin during a clean-up and also issues to do with water quality in the estuary at Mapua. We have a very big one coming out soon again, which is one that Morgan started, and I don't know that I would have quite had the courage to start it, but anyway, finished it now, which is around the review of the leasehold land in the South Island, you know, the big Crown-owned high country sheep stations that are actually owned by the Crown, and the environmental impacts of that. And that has been a very broad with many, many issues, and a situation in which you can find that one thing that's good for the environment can clash with another thing that's good for the environment. It's not always win-win. That's tricky. We have some work going on at the moment in the office on what are known as smart meters, which to do with the meter you have for your electricity consumption is just one that counts how many kilowatt hours you use. And there is a lot of innovation going on in other countries and here to some extent on so-called smart meters, where they can do clever things. And our concern here is that the electricity retailers are rolling out smart meters to customers, not just people in homes, but other businesses as well, which can deliver benefits to them, but not necessarily to the consumer or indeed to the environment. And so I've been interested in the electricity consumption for a long time. In fact, my master's work, how many years ago is it now, 30-odd years ago, in California when I worked there, was around this idea of reducing demand instead of constantly increasing supply. And the smart meters do offer the prospect of a really significant change there. And so ultimately you might have a situation where you might have a smart appliance like a refrigerator, for example, and it's coming up to peak time for electricity when you're turning on your fossil fuel power stations, and so the CO2 being generated and not a good situation, and you can send electronic signals via the smart meters to communicate, two-way communication with the appliances in your house. So it might be said without any of your knowledge to your refrigerator, do not turn on the defrost function during this time. Or it might say, do not do the heating cycle for the dishwasher now. So there is a way to reduce consumption that is invisible, really, to people, but they can sign up to this, and this would help keep down electricity bills and all sorts of things like that. So we're doing work on smart meters there. And, of course, our interest really is in the ultimate effect on carbon dioxide generation from electricity. Got another project going also around lignite, the possible conversion of lignite in Southland to transport fuels, and we're worried about the carbon footprint of that, so we're doing some calculations there. Is that enough for you, Tim?
Yes, you mentioned about up in the, say, the high country, like, is it the poisons? Is it the 1080 poisons, when they're dropped, some within the conservation department see it's a definite benefit, whilst Others say, well, look, yes, there's that fall off there when it gets into water. I see some pretty grotesque pictures on TV over last week where they show a kura, a freshwater crayfish, with a particular poison. Would you look into that and say, well, look, we've got to get to a clear understanding where this is used and when it's used or not used at all?
Yes, and we do get complaints into the office about 1080. The Environmental Risk Management Authority has recently reviewed pretty thoroughly the use of 1080. 1080 is a really difficult one because it is an unusual poison in that it does degrade in the environment. Of course, the problem becomes when it kills animals and birds and so on, eat those animals where it hasn't degraded. So, you know, it is not a desirable thing to use. The problem is what to do instead. And I would imagine there must be quite a lot of scientific work going on around this area. Maybe something that we pick up at some stage. We don't have room for it at the moment, but certainly I note the growing concern around it. But New Zealand does use a lot of it, but this possum problem is pretty special for us. It is quite extraordinary when you go somewhere where there aren't possums, and I did this a while ago going to Kapiti Island, you know, near Wellington, which is pest-free, and you notice the sheer thickness of the bush and the canopy of the trees because all those growing tips aren't chewed out. So it's a difficult one, but certainly something that we could validly pursue at some point. But for me, the big one is climate change.
Definitely.
Because that dwarfs everything else.
Definitely, and my question will lead over a little bit. Acidic oceans, it's becoming very pronounced just over the last few weeks that the oceans are moving more and more acidic. And, of course, we are surrounded by oceans. I guess this is going to come more and more into the public consciousness as the months and years go by.
I don't know about that particular issue. I know that part of this is oceans becoming more acidic. I think that where the models that the climate change scientists develop of what would happen, there's quite a lot of variation between those models, but they're all about what would happen in particular regions with any detail around that in terms of the predictions, although there's a growing consistency about the global picture, if you like. There are very great consistency there. But the effects of climate change will be felt in the increased frequency of severe events, extreme events like droughts and storms and floods and so on. And that's, I think, what people will notice. Although, of course, one can't attribute a particular extreme event to climate change at the moment because these things do occur from time to time. But there is certainly a lot of much universal agreement that we will see an increase in these events, and of course they affect people very directly. I mean, we are fortunate in New Zealand that we're not living in a delta like Bangladesh.
Very much so. And so how would you nudge this whole subject
along?
Along, that's right.
Well, we're doing it really in a couple of ways. One of the things I'm concerned about is the so-called growing skeptic, climate change skeptic movement in New Zealand. I'm all for people being skeptical and checking things out, but there is the media in New Zealand have given the climate change skeptics a lot of time
50%.
Relative to their numbers, if you like.
Yes.
And the problem is that someone can write a letter to the newspaper and say, well, there's a particular argument that shows that climate change isn't really happening, you know, the world's really cooling and so on, and then a scientist might write in and say, might be from, you know, who's thoroughly works in climate change all the time and has been maybe a representative at the International Panel on Climate Change, and will write in and say, well, actually that argument's not correct because of such and such. And then the next week we can get another letter making the same claim, and so quite easy to sow a lot of doubt about the scientific consensus among the general public and indeed among MPs. And so I had an article in the Dominion Post just before Christmas which pointed out how the climate change skeptics among the scientists, and there are some scientists who are climate change skeptics for various reasons, are really a tiny minority, and that the consensus among mainstream scientists is indeed very strong and increasingly gloomy, actually, which I don't like to think about, but it's true. And I put this article in the paper, and this created quite a number of letters written in as a result of that that were quite angry with me for saying this. So explaining that science and explaining how the advice is all of the different strands of the science are integrated internationally through this body called the IPCC is something that I expect to increasingly do to different groups. And the other aspect of it, which we're working on, or two really, is around trying to mitigate the effects. And one of the main ways of doing that is through so-called carbon pricing, which is enormously complicated and quite difficult to understand. And in New Zealand, we have gone thus far for this emissions trading scheme, which has hardly been started, of course, because now we're looking at amendments to it. So both through giving advice to select committees, but also explaining what it's all about is, I think, a function that I will increasingly perform. So when I'm invited to talk to particular groups, I often use that. This is the topic. So whether they're community groups or groups of business people, I say, right, well, I'm going to tell you why carbon pricing is really important and what the difference is between a carbon tax and a cap and trade system, which are the two ways of going about it, and take it from there. And I find people really have a real thirst to understand this. But, you know, we are talking, it's very difficult for the public because we're talking about putting a price on something. You think about carbon dioxide, it's invisible, it's odourless, and so on. And we're putting a price on something that's never been priced before. So, of course, it's very difficult for people to comprehend why you would need to do that. But it's not the whole answer to mitigation either, can I add?
Very good. I'm speaking with Jan Wright in Wellington. She's the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment. Yes, Jan, because New Zealand is supposed to be paying between $700 million and possibly $1 billion regarding our debt, shall we say, for greenhouse gases. Mm. And a lot of people say, OK, now, where's that money going to? I'd like to think that that money, all of it, virtually goes to a country that needs to put in more trees or stop soil erosion. But a lot of people say, no, this money gets just dissolved. We don't actually know where that goes. Do you know what the story is with that?
What the idea is that eventually there would be a global limit to the emissions, and that if you are, you can sell the right to emit to other people. Now, if you sell the right to emit to someone else, then you have to reduce your own emissions, you see. So it would be, you're talking about our Kyoto obligation, the amount of money we're going to have to pay in 2012, because it will be represent the cost of our carbon emissions above our 1990 level, right?
Yes.
So if we can get our emissions lower down, we have to pay less, that's one thing. But the money would go to overseas, to other countries in the agreement who, and it'd be used to invest in carbon dioxide reducing things like energy efficiency and so on. So it's not, but it is enormously complex, and I don't pretend to understand it all fully, but I do know that the fundamental reason, if I could just talk for a moment about why on earth do we need to price this carbon dioxide? And I'm not saying it's the whole answer. We need to price it because we use the atmosphere as a sink for this waste gas, and there are other greenhouse gases as well, but I won't try to complicate things, which, and the problem is that the capacity of the atmosphere to absorb this waste gas is running out. And, of course, unwittingly, for centuries, humankind has done this with a big spurt with the Industrial Revolution, the use of coal and so on, of course, but still increasing very rapidly now. So the problem is that every time we use energy, we emit carbon dioxide. And so even if you take a renewable fuel like biofuel, if you look at, for example, the growing of maize in the United States to turn it into ethanol as a substitute for petrol, and that is subsidized by the US government, you think about the growing of that maize, you are using diesel in the tractors as you work the land, you are using coal to generate electricity that will run, you know, your processing plant and the heat that you need there, and so on and so forth. So there is a lot of fossil fuel involved in the production of that particular renewable form of energy, if you're with me. So, and this happens with many things, that there is carbon dioxide coming from the fossil fuel right through processes. So by pricing it, what you actually do is let the economic system catch that for you, because otherwise it becomes incredibly difficult to try and work out what the carbon footprint is. I mean, somebody rather facetiously in a newspaper article recently said, well, walking to work, all very well, but I'll walk to work and I'll eat more food, and that will have a carbon footprint. So you can't win. Everything you do has got a carbon footprint. And it's only by pricing it that you can actually let the economic system calculate that carbon footprint for you. I hope that's clear. Let me try something else. Someone once said to me that typically a head of broccoli in a supermarket in New Zealand goes on 7 trips. You travel 7 times on different forms. Now, I have no idea if that's true or not. It might be. But if you had a pricing of the carbon dioxide that had gone into the growing of that broccoli and its appearance in a supermarket, then a much travelled head of broccoli would be relatively more expensive than a little travelled head of broccoli. And so people would tend to then go for the little travelled head of broccoli, if you're with me.
Mm.
So it's a question of signals right through an economy.
Jan, because you are involved with Parliament, do you go out to lunch with the MPs, and are you allowed to socialise with them?
I have to be careful on this one, Tim. No, I can't say I've been out to lunch with any MPs, certainly not since I've been in this job. But any MP can ask to see me, to ask my views on any group of them. But what I tend to do, well, in fact, what I do do, rather than tend to do, is if I go to meet with any MP or a group of MPs, I will always take another member of my staff with me, just in case there is the possibility of a hint of my adopting the party political position of the MP or group of MPs I've gone to see. Do you understand that? That's a sort of a risk management thing around the independence. It's very important that I'm not exposed in that way. So this is certainly not, if you like, an intimate relationship with any particular MPs. Mm. But I make myself available. I go and meet with chairs of select committees and brief ministers on reports that we might be coming out with that could affect them, which might contain recommendations to them. You know, there are so many people in this role that one could interact with. I have been to lunch with the Board of Federated Farmers, for example.
It's a good idea. Though climate change, of course, is the issue, can I question here, where does GE come into this, bearing in mind that New Zealanders in general are not really for it?
Well, look, I'm not going to make any comments on GE here, Tim. It's not something I've dealt with in my time as Commissioner. And if it starts to become an issue again, we might get involved, but we would have to look at it very carefully. But I can't just make a statement without some work behind it. I understand that.
Yes, I can understand. I just felt that if they did a great planting of GE seed out there, then you would come in and say, well, look, we've got to see what's happening overseas, because I know that, I think in India, a lot of the Indians are going against GE. It hasn't proved what they wanted.
Mm.
Okay, now...
Mm. Very difficult area.
It is. Mm. With Antarctica, 3 years ago, we witnessed icebergs floating past New Zealand.
Mm.
What is the possibility of a gigantic ice sheet sliding off a rock shelf? Is looking at an overseas threat part of your jurisdiction?
Well, certainly we need to understand where the science is on this and what the views are. I think that the most scary thing about climate change, to to me two things. One of them is that you get feedback loops, and most of those associated with climate change seem to be the wrong kind of feedback loops. For example, in the Arctic, where you're getting far north, where you're getting the most dramatic temperature changes thus far, you're replacing white reflective ice with basically dark green, if you like, a blackish sea. And of course, it's much more absorbent of the solar radiation that falls on it. So you get a change to what's known as the Earth's albedo, which is an interesting word, meaning its reflectivity. And so the more ice you melt and replace with sea, the faster that heating effect goes. And those feedback loops, positive feedback loops, are frightening. So there's not a moderating, there are some moderating effects the other way, but in general they seem to be in the accelerating rather than the curving direction, if you're with me. The second thing that is truly worrying is tipping points, discontinuities, where you get a certain situation where maybe a major ice sheet does suddenly slide off into the sea. So instead of a steady, slow rise in the average temperature of the globe, which we might be able to, many of us might be able to adjust to, you get quite a sudden effect, quite a big effect in a short time, and that is frightening, frankly. I do put climate change out there as the biggest worry, because it does, in fact, really affect practically every other environmental issue that we're concerned about. I mean, for example, we were talking about the high country a moment ago. The ecology, the plants that grow in the high country of New Zealand, will be the ones that are affected the most earliest, because they are the ones that already are subject to extreme temperatures. So when summer and winter changes, so when you get more extreme summer and winter changes, you'll start to lose species. And so the biodiversity is at risk from climate change, and so many other things.
Yes, I know that regarding the migration of certain species, they are leaving later because it could be warmer here and it doesn't get cold. And so by leaving later, they get to the other place on the other side of the planet. And because of climate extremes up there, a pupa or caterpillars or whatever could have come into a particular stage and move through a stage. So when they land, these birds, say, land in this country to eat the caterpillar, the caterpillar's actually changed to a butterfly and flying away. And
all of the timing's out.
That's right. And so these are the big ones that, of course, don't get into the media. How does the media come across? I know that you said before that the newspapers possibly, they nearly do give 50% of time to the skeptics as well as what the believers, for want of a word. And television and radio, do you find that you've been able to get a more balanced response?
Well, I can't actually generalise about that, Tim. I'm not sure it is 50-50 with the climate change, but the one problem I do find with the media is that when I make recommendations, to ministers or government departments or to whoever they are, that I also like to make commendations, if I can, commending what is being well done. So I'm not always being negative and saying this isn't good enough, but I find that the media is not interested in that. So I can issue a press release that says the government's actually done the right thing here, and this is really good, and it will be largely ignored by the media. But as soon as I say something critical of the government, boom, it's a different story. But that is certainly not just restricted to environment or my position at all. It's a general thing that bad news makes good stories, isn't it? Bad news sells newspapers.
Regrettably. Now, could you walk us through a situation here? You have got some information to pass, and you take it to the Speaker of the House. In this case, this is Lockwood Smith. Would you approach him in the House, or would you approach him outside the House, and then he would stand up, call everybody to order, and say, this is what happens? Could you?
Oh, no, not like that. Not like that important. No, what we do, suppose we finish an investigation and take the MAPA one, for example, which we did last year, or the tenure review one, which we'll be doing shortly, which are major reports, investigations. I can't release them until, as it were, I've given it to Parliament. That's the first rule. So they must be tabled in the House of Parliament. So on the day that we will release a report of that kind, then we need to take, I think it's 50 copies. I'm not quite sure why it's 50. I might be wrong about that, but someone in my office knows. I don't have to worry about it. Over to Parliament in the morning, and it has to be a, you know, a sitting day of Parliament, when you're sitting and not in recess. And the Speaker will then table them in the House. So he will announce that this investigation has been completed, and here it is. And then MPs who are interested will get a copy of the report and read it. Now, but it's not until that has been done, that tabling in the House has happened, that I can release publicly what the report says. So typically later that day, I might, if it's a relatively big report, I might do a session with the media and possibly hold a public meeting of some kind for people who are involved or particularly interested in the subject. So then it becomes public. So the Parliament has to be the first to know. It's basically the method.
And is it imperative that every parliamentarian read it, or do they give it to one of their assistants further on down the chain who will skim it and take out the knowledge? Or how is this conveyed to the MP who then most probably has to take it back to his electorate?
Yes. Well, the MPs who are interested obviously will read, but there's actually been a change recently to the standing orders of Parliament. In my case, what happens is that these investigations of this kind are now being referred always to one of the select committees of Parliament, which is called Local Government and Environment, and they receive my report and then have to write a report on my report for Parliament, and will almost certainly ask for a briefing from me, a presentation on the report, and then I would have to do that and answer questions on the report. I would also offer give a briefing to other committees where it might be more relevant to the work of that committee. For instance, if it was on agriculture, some aspect of agriculture, I might certainly give a briefing to local government environment, but it might be more important to give a briefing to the primary production committee, which deals with agricultural matters. So that is sort of the way it works, and also any of the caucuses could ask to have a briefing, or individual MPs, in fact, if we could find the time to do that. We try to get the message across, obviously, and also some of these messages won't be absorbed straight away, so these projects can have quite a tail where you keep repeating the messages which come in the form of the recommendations. We do follow up on those recommendations to see if they've been adopted, and we have, in fact, a performance indicator, as it's known in Wellington jargon, around the percentage of those recommendations that are actually adopted or partly adopted. So it's really trying to follow through and not just do the report and sort of leave it, but do the report and write to the minister and say, okay, well, there's three recommendations to you here and we see you've done one of them, but what about the other two? That sort of thing. So there's a persistence required here.
And I would presume too that because all the MPs are in many ways overworked, or not overworked, they've got stuff coming in at them all the time, that they just haven't got the time to absorb it all.
That's right. And it's one of my aims that our reports should be short.
Yes.
In order that, and readable, and have varying success on that. But what we do try to do is give presentations that are easy to listen to and they can follow. So we do put a lot of time into those, and we put a lot of effort in writing the report into making conclusions and recommendations very clear, because in a way that's the guts of the report, the most important part. And I also personally write a preface to every report in which I try to write in very clear language the things in it that are important. That's almost functions as a bit of a summary as well, an accessible summary.
Very good. Thank you, Jan. And I'm speaking with Jan Wright. She's the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment, and she's in Wellington. So, Jan, what has excited you about the position of Parliamentary Commission? What excites you there? You think, yes.
Can I say that I've never had a job in my life that was so unboring and stretches me in every single direction. I think what excites me is the independence, so that you can actually do a piece of work and then not be really be able to think of who needs to hear this. What could we really do that would make a difference? And I've been there myself with doing work on environment where you describe a problem, and you can describe a problem, environmental problem, forever in a way, because there are so many dimensions to them. But that challenge to try and find solutions that will can possibly be taken up, at least in part, for moving ahead, that's really exciting. And I also find that I do have a small office, but I don't actually complain about that, because I like having a small office, because we can really, we don't have to have a lot of structure within it. So it's a very flat office and a very collegial atmosphere and very free debate and discussion and questioning of each other among the people who work here. And that's actually a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun in the office, and really, I think, are developing a culture where we can question each other and it's not threatening. That's a really nice thing to be able to do.
Yes, yes, one team. And how's your overview of nature as a whole expanded? Because you would have really got a greater understanding of the web of life and the couplings within the ecology, how it all sort of comes together.
Yes. Well, I wish I could do with more of that. My background, actually, I'm not a biologist of any kind by background. I'm actually a physicist originally, and I've done other training. I've done a lot of work in energy and then a number of environmental matters, but I do retain that fundamental interest in energy. And of course, the urgency around energy now is to do with carbon dioxide and climate change, so I'm very much in that space. But at the same time, there's nothing quite like being out in the bush, is there? It's a wonderful magic country that we live in, and it's precious.
Do you feel that your team can see things more in a holistic perspective?
Well, what we do is have a variety of training among the team. So we have people who are qualified. Let me just run off. We've got chemistry of various kinds. We've got biology of various kinds. We've got physics, meteorology, geology, economics, policy. These skills are engineering within the office. So we do have that disciplinary mix. And I think that by things being working in teams and free to open debate, you can get these different perspectives coming in all the time. But we also try to put ourselves in the heads of the decision maker and think, what kinds of things would they respond to? And that's an interesting stretching exercise. But yes, the holistic thing is always there. I mean, I like to think very much big picture. And when you think big picture, you do see the connections. And what you do tend to find, though, is sometimes one thing that's good for the environment in one dimension is bad for the environment in another, and that becomes difficult. So it's not just a question of the environment against everything else. Sometimes there are things between different environmental goods vying with each other.
Can you give us one quick example of that?
Well, I could, really, yes. And this is not one that I would wish to be seen as promulgating, but the high country, go back to the high country, of course, we've got a lot of wilding pines there that seem to be out of control.
Wilding pines?
Well, pines, pine trees, conifers,
yes,
that are spreading of their own accord and self-seeding. And really, the high country is in a sort of natural trajectory back to woody species. The original vegetation that was there has been gone for many centuries, burnt out many years ago, and we're used to the high country looking as this pastoral landscape with the sheep farming. Of course, that's a relatively recent thing. Now, there are people around who say, well, carbon storage, trees, carbon storage, or maybe better still, biochar, which would do less damage to your landscapes. But there is this, so there's a situation where you might say, well, look, let's do trees in some of the high country anyway to store carbon. But then you might say, well, if we did it there in that catchment, then our river flows would decrease. And that would be bad for the life of the river, but it also would be bad if there were hydroelectricity being generated on that river. And there wasn't as much water, so we then had to burn more fossil fuel. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of, it's kind of like a detective thing of following through these different connections and seeing where they lead you. And it's not exactly clear where you should be going, but so many people do have this kind of clarity in their own thinking, but it's because of looking at it through one particular lens often, which is perfectly valid, but there'll be other people looking at it through other lenses.
Yes. And finally, where...
So I think what's environmentally right to do is where I'm getting to is not always that obvious.
Yes, there's so many variables all the time. So where do you see yourself, and particularly the Parliamentary Commission for the Environment, where do you see this going in the future? We've got a challenging future. I'm always optimistic. And how do you see that we need to, without you putting yourself too far into an unenviable situation or of saying, well, I've got to keep out of it from a political point of view, where do you see things going, or how do you think they can actually show up, sort of sunny side up?
Well, there's where you might see things going, where you would like them to go, which is somewhat different. I think for us in this country, you know, we talk an awful lot about this clean, green image, and it does actually have real economic value, and that's an important message we need to get home to everybody. I think that with world population the way it's going, what we've got is a situation where wilderness is becoming increasingly scarce, and beautiful wilderness even more so. And so what we have here with our natural environment is of actually great, it's got to be of increasing value globally. And so we need to look after that, if I'm just making a purely economic argument about the environment. And I think that we are fortunate in a way in this country because we have quite a lineup of environment with economy around tourism. And so what is good for tourism, what is good for the environment, in many situations is going to be good for tourism as well. We rely, many of our companies rely on that clean green image in trying to sell things overseas. So if, for example, we pulled out of international efforts on climate change and said, oh, we can't be bothered with all this carbon dioxide problem, then that would do enormous business damage. We'd probably find all sorts of tariffs being, maybe blocks coming into countries, that trade barriers that come into countries that have signed up or stuck with Kyoto Agreement and the agreements that will follow it. So there is a significant alignment there. It's much harder for Australia, actually, because Australia's economy is based on coal and minerals and mining and large burning of particularly dirty brown coal. So I'd like to see that. I did find in some old, an old cupboard the other day, a speech by Helen Hughes, which would probably be, I've forgotten the year, but getting on for 20 years old, in which she was said New Zealand's clean green image fact or reality, and I thought, things don't change much.
Yes.
Because that really is an issue for me now. So you can't say this is not of importance to the economy. It's important to us in many ways. It's also fundamental, I think, to our view of ourselves as a people. That's how we see, if we define New Zealand, that's how we see ourselves. It is in terms of greenness.
Yes, and sustainable and renewal, to make sure that we do the right thing, particularly for the children of tomorrow.
Absolutely.
And the Parliamentary Commission for the Environment, your little organisation, which is, it's there for the long term.
Well, it's there created by legislation. Legislation can be amended and it can disappear. So that's an issue, you know. Again, it's thinking about recommendations. If I became offensive and rude and that sort of thing to government, they might say, we don't really like her being around, let's get rid of her. I mean, I sometimes use the joke of, bit of a joke, if you recall, Thomas a Becket was the murderer in the cathedral back in medieval times in England, and the king was rumoured to have said, "Who will rid me of this troublesome priest?" And on him saying that, some of his soldiers rushed into the cathedral and broke the sanctuary. They weren't supposed to do this, and murdered Thomas a Becket. And I think, who will rid me of this troublesome commissioner? So, you know, there is longevity of things to consider as well. So that's part of it. But I think I don't see any threat to the continuation of the office at the moment at all. But who knows in the future?
Well, I feel it's just a high value for us as a country to have such a gift as an add-on to government.
It is unusual. It is unusual to have this degree of independence. You find commissioners for sustainable development and commissioners for the environment of various kinds around the world. But, I mean, if you go to Australia, the different states have them there. But I know a little bit about the commissioner in the state of Victoria in Melbourne. He's actually a New Zealander. And he's part of government. So there are, the closest, I believe, is Ontario in Canada that has a commissioner that is independent. I don't know that the independence goes quite as far as the independence of my position, but it is confusing because there are many commissioners in Wellington. We've got electricity commissioners and commerce commissioners and children's commissioner and retirement commissioner and so on, and yet those are all appointees of government and subject to government direction, whereas my role is unique in that way, and as I say, it's like the roles of the Auditor General and the Ombudsman. So it's a pretty precious thing, yes.
It is.
Very privileged to be in this very exciting job.
Lovely, that's fantastic. Yeah. Jan, I'd say thank you very much for sharing and letting us know just what is happening with the Parliamentary Commission, and also thank you very much for sharing of yourself.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim.
That was Jan Wright, the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment, and the website is www.pce.govt.nz.